Welcome back to the Ron Thulin Show. 27 minutes past the hour at 12 o'clock. Yesterday, we gave you a brief history, you might remember, of the Marine Corps as they were celebrating their anniversary. Today, I want to give you a little bit of history behind Veterans Day. Now, World War I officially ended on June 28, 1919, in the signing of the Treaty of Versailles. However, the actual fighting did stop about 7 months earlier with armistice, which went into effect on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918. Now, Armistice Day officially became a holiday in 1926. 12 years later, it became a national holiday. In 1953, in Emporia, Kansas, the people called this day Veterans Day, and soon after, Congress passed a bill renaming Armistice Day Veterans Day in order to honor all the vets. Then in 1971, I'm going to test you on this, by the way. You better be writing all this down. 1971, President Nixon declared it a federal holiday to be celebrated on the second Monday in 1978. But the observance was changed back to its original date because everybody realized November 11th was such a historic day. Now, the sad part of all of this, when I started thinking about this, and actually Lori and I have been planning this for about a week or two, all the events surrounding Veterans Day, there are fewer and fewer parades and ceremonies that we have seen. Vets still do gather at the Vietnam Memorial in Washington. Families who have lost sons, daughters, or fathers and mothers still use this day as a remembrance. But I don't think our kids understand how important and how critical and how solemn this day really is. And when you think back to World War I, saw a report today there are fewer than 50 soldiers alive who fought in World War I of the estimated 12 million who served. With each death of these soldiers, a little bit of history unfortunately fades away. A lot of it due to the fact we didn't have television. We didn't have any way to record a lot of that. However, World War II is still fresh in many minds. We talked about it yesterday, and the stories continue long after the war had come to an end. Here is an incredible story. And this is a book. If you have a father or a mother that had served, you're going to want to get this. Conrad Netting III was only 26 years old when his plane crashed in France just 4 days after D-Day. He left behind his young wife, Catherine, and a month after his death, a son, Conrad IV, was born. Now, the son had little knowledge of his father and what he went through until after his mother's death, he found a footlocker. And in it were memories and answers about his dad. All of this is detailed in the book, Delayed Legacy. And Conrad Netting IV, who lives in San Antonio, joins me now. Conrad, good to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
First of all, incredible story.
It is. It's just one of those things that opened up for us, and we had to do something with it, so we've written a book.
Not bad for a CPA.
No. No, I may be the only CPA author on the planet.
The only one we can understand.
Maybe that's best.
How about that? Yeah. You know, as I mentioned, you were born a month after your father's death in France. What is your earliest memory of your mom talking about him?
Well, it was probably, I must have been maybe 8 or 10 years old, and I heard a little bit about the flag. We flew a flag every Veterans Day and every Flag Day, and eventually I heard that that flag had been on my father's casket and when he was buried at the American Military Cemetery in Normandy. So we had that, and that would generate conversation. We did talk about him. It was never anything that she held back. Uh-huh. It's just that over time, you just don't get a lot of conversation every night at dinner about, well, you know, let me tell you about your dad. So when the subject came up, she was very open, but obviously over a number of years that declined a little bit. We just didn't talk about it very much.
As you grew older, were there any clues as to what your father was like? Did your mom kind of drop down and say, you know, you remind me of, or somebody else?
Yes, she did. She was very conversant about him and didn't hold, as I said, didn't hold anything back. I did also run into some classmates of him. He went to Jefferson, class of 1936, and they were very open and said, your father was a wonderful man and would tell me all the neat things about him. My favorite story is they said he was a party boy. And I said,
I don't know if I want to hear that about my dad. I can't picture Ernie as a party boy.
Right. No, they were, I think that was in a little different tone than it was today. But he was a very sociable person, very a pleasant person, and had a ton of friends, many of whom I've heard from since the book came out. They're still calling me, and I have lunch with one, in fact, on Monday.
That's great. Now, as a young boy, you had to be curious, but was it painful? And could you see the pain in your mom's face and in her eyes and her voice when she talked about it?
No, I must say I didn't. There was pain, obviously. There was no father in the house. I did grow up with an uncle who remained a bachelor his entire life. And so he was a male image figure, and that worked out great. But there was no pain really to speak of. I do have some letters from her to me when I was in college in the 60s, mm-hmm. And that those letters do reveal some of that. So it was, I think, on her heart, as she didn't remarry until she was, I was 28, so it was 28 years after my father died.
You did have male influences in your life during your younger days. Were they the ones in charge of discipline? Because that's the first thing yes. we hear of is that you were the mama's boy. Did you have the discipline?
Well, first of all, my mother was pretty good disciplinarian herself.
That's good.
She let nothing get by her. And then when I did have three uncles, mm-hmm. One of whom lived in the home with us. The other two were married and had children, my cousins. And when everybody got together, the one in charge of discipline was the one closest to what was going wrong. So you were never far from discipline in my house, but be it male or female.
Yeah, my mother was in charge of discipline. She was always within arm reach of what was going wrong.
Those arms got long, too.
It was, you know, people talk about the Incredible Hulk. No, my mother's arms could stretch like 15 blocks. She'd grab me. It was not a problem. As a young boy, you looked up and you saw the stars. One of the parts I read is your mother said that your dad, if I'm not mistaken, that your dad was the brightest star.
Right.
Did you walk out and talk to him? Did you walk out and feel different?
No, I just felt like he was behind one of those stars. Of course, at that age, you don't know what a star is. I'm not sure I know today even. But you felt like, okay, there's a little bright light up there, and kind of maybe he's kind of behind that and watching me and being careful of what I do and me being careful that he would be watching me. I think the earliest recollection I have, though, is that she would say, well, now, when you say you're our father who art in heaven, that's you're talking to your father, too. So be aware of that. So we had that that connection, and I was aware of that from an early age.
How come your mom never remarried till later on? Is that part of the love story?
I think it is. She was devoted to him in every sense of the word, and her last letters to him in a journal that she kept long after he was declared missing in action. She kept a journal for over 6 months, written more or less to him, but also as therapy for herself. In those letters, it's just absolutely clear how devoted they were to each other. Mm-hmm. Even though they'd only been married a year or just under a year when he died, and that they had only dated a year or two before that. But during the war, everything was accelerated. There was no time for long engagements and all of that. So there was plenty of evidence of their devotion to each other, and I think that just continued. She did finally remarry, was married 20 years, devoted to that gentleman, but it just wasn't something that was going to happen very soon.
Was she incredibly strong?
Oh, yes. She not only was 21 years old and widowed and now with a young baby, a new baby, but had virtually, and much like many women in those days, no prospects for much of a career. In 1944, you just didn't have a lot. So she went out and was very strong in her profession. She helped found a small drug company here in town in the 40s that then later sold to a much bigger firm in the 60s. And was originally responsible for Lubriderm lotion, which is still on the shelves today. And that was invented here in San Antonio. So she helped shepherd that company to its ultimate sale and move to New Jersey, which she declined to go to.
That's a smart move. Your mother was also smart.
Yes. They said, guess what? You're going to New Jersey. And she said, guess what? I retire.
Yeah, guess what? I'm done.
So there was that. She then went from that not to be this. She was probably in her early 50s then and decided that she was going to not give up on work. So she helped with a big local charity, the San Antonio Area Foundation, and was their first executive director. So strong woman is very clearly an adjective that goes with her.
And a strong faith.
I
got the sense that that kept her going.
It certainly did. And if that, if I didn't make that clear in the book, I failed because she was absolutely all over the map on her faith. She was at church, Sunday school teacher of 5-year-olds for 20 years. That's church here in town. She got me involved in church, which I still am. She was a supporter of the youth group when I got of that age. And she was just, she was very, very strong, and that's evident in her letters.
And I think you have to almost put this into context because now we see single moms, and it's very, very common. Mm-hmm. It's not a big deal.
Right.
But we're talking a completely different time here where, as you mentioned, you just don't go out and get a job.
Mm-mm.
You don't have the benefits that you have right now.
Mm-mm.
And when you look back at that, not only is she has a broken heart, but she has to be strong for you.
Mm-hmm.
That's an incredible story in itself right mm-hmm. there.
Yep. She was the strength for both of us. No question about that. She, you're right. The single mothers today just don't have a whole different set of situations than they had then. And not only was it just a single mother, but a single mother with a deceased husband was not that common. Now, there are estimates, 180,000, I think, of children left fatherless by the war. And I'm one of them. But other than those, of course, there were millions of children who came afterward and went on with their lives. The euphoria after World War II was palatable. It was just on every street corner. But then there were those who had lost their husbands who said, well, I'm not quite euphoric yet, so you all go on and go on without me.
Did you ever resent not having a dad?
Oh, I probably did on occasion. You know, as a youngster, you kind of say, well, where is he and how come and so on. I remember none of those conversations.
Really?
Maybe I've conveniently blanked them out. But my mother was strong enough to provide the background and the depth for both parents, I believe. Plus my uncle, I have to say, was always there and helped with, you know, the baseball games and with the picnics and so on. So there was plenty of that. But it just was not with a father. I did have, and this is in the book, I did say, I can remember clearly thinking, oh, what if he just walked in tomorrow morning? What if this was all a big mistake? And what if, what if he shows up? I wonder what we'll do. We'll go buy him some clothes. We'll get him a car. Won't this be fun? I'll show him to all my friends, and this will be just amazing. And of course, then sleep comes, and that dream doesn't come true.
What did you tell your friends? Because I'm sure they're saying, "Hey, Conrad, where's your dad?
Oh, yes.
You got a dad?"
Yeah, we had that a lot, it was never a teasing kind of sense of that. It was just, oh, okay, that's the fact. And as I said, there were I grew up with a number of people, many still in town, who had also lost their fathers. Now their mothers might have remarried earlier, and therefore they had kind of moved on in that sense. But there was plenty there was never a sense of kidding about that. I remember going to the Whitty Museum, and there's a plaque there with all those from San Antonio who were killed in the war, and my dad's name was up there, and I was always very, very eager to point that out. Right, to the big bullies who might think otherwise about my physical stature. I say, well, look at my dad's up here, and he'll take care of you.
That's good. That's a great point of pride.
Right.
Now, there are those who lose parents in a war sometimes have a tendency to have some problems, be it emotional, physical, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Did you have any of those?
Well, you'd have to ask my wife, I guess, but I don't think so.
Is that a safe thing to do, Conrad?
No, maybe not. I think I am the rare, a more unusual case than most. I belong to a group called American World War II Orphans Network, and that's abbreviated AWON, and we call it AWON. And AWON provides a wonderful service for any fatherless children from the war who may have had emotional scars or whose mothers may have even denied the existence of their natural fathers. And that's not uncommon. And if the mothers did not deny it, they at least were not as open about it as my mother was. So there is a place for people who have those scars and who have those issues that they can go and meet with other people in a support setting that can talk to them about that. Plus of which, this organization will do just moves mountains to help people find out about their fathers and what units they were in and how they died and so forth. So it's a great unit.
We're talking with Conrad Nitting. The name of the book is Delayed Legacy. We'll tell you where you can get it. It's got some great pictures on it. The cover is fabulous. Now, the Foot Locker, that's kind of where all this really kicks into high gear here. Did you see this Foot Locker in your house?
Yes.
Did you ever wonder what was in there, and what did your mom say?
No.
It was locked, right?
It was locked, and in fact, when we did...
You were curious? Like, wow, what's in here?
Yes, but it was out in the attic, the garage attic, and I, you know, every Saturday, go out and cut the grass, get the lawnmower, and say, get these, there's those Foot Lockers, and never crossed my mind that anything could be in there other than just an occasional this or that.
Right.
And in fact, in two or three of them of my uncle's, there was very little in there, nothing really, almost worth keeping. And then the last one we opened happened to be this one of my dad's, and we couldn't open it. It was sealed shut. I mean, we had crowbars and screwdrivers and everything, and trying to pop this thing open. And finally, with my son and a bunch of teenagers, they finally got it open, and we were just overcome when we saw what was in there.
And this was after your mom had passed away.
Correct.
So you got all the stuff out of the house. Got these footlockers out of the house, and then it wasn't until your son and some friends opened it up.
Well, they were there. We had called all my cousins together and said, let's open these footlockers. I'm not keeping them another 50 years, so let's see what's in them. So we had a backyard picnic. It happened to be the 4th of July.
Did you find that kind of odd that your whole family... I mean, it just happenstance that your whole family was there, and all of a sudden, everybody shows up on this.
No, it wasn't happenstance. We invited them. We said, we've got to open these things.
That you're going to open these things, and you made it a big...
Mm-hmm.
No idea. And you had no clue. Nobody did.
No clue.
Your mother never told anybody else that, hey, I should go.
Nothing. And we opened it. We said nothing for maybe, I don't know, a minute or 30 seconds or something. I mean, 14 people just without a word to say, because here in this footlocker, which had been sealed, as I said, plus had a million mothballs in there, were his uniforms carefully folded with the breast of the jacket showing with the medals on it, the name tag, letters wrapped up in thin, very tiny black ribbons, letters both ways for maybe 2 years were in that footlocker. His shower clogs, his Mae West, his everything he had with him in England when he died, plus all the letters that she had put in when the footlocker came back over.
I want to take a break because I want to get into the letters and the shock that must have crossed your face and what you were feeling there, because there had to be a connection with your dad that you had never had before. And I want to take a break, George, if you don't mind. It's about 44 past 12 o'clock. 524-1310, by the way, is our number. 524-1310. The name of the book, Delayed Legacy, A Son's Amazing Search for the Full Story of His Father's Death After D-Day. Conrad Nitting IV. Is our guest in the picture on the front of the book. I want to ask you about that, because that is just... And you look like your dad.
No, thank you. I'm nice.
We're going to take a break. You're listening to the Ron Thulin Show on KAHL Call 1310. Be right back in a moment.
Now, having been in San Antonio for over 20 years, I really thought I knew the best Mexican restaurants in town. I had a favorite one for margaritas, another one for salsa, who had the best nachos and enchiladas. I still can't believe it took a personal invitation from the owners of Cha-Cha's on Babcock for me to discover this incredible restaurant. From the first step into Cha-Cha's, a delightful dining area on your left for the families, one on your right for a quieter, more intimate dining experience with gazebos and flowers, and then the wonderful flavors from appetizers to desserts. And wait till you get to the margaritas, made the way they should be. Frozen so thick you might want to eat them with a spoon. Marge Ruiz brought to San Antonio all her mother's wonderful recipes for Michoacan, with special flavors and complexity you simply don't find in everyday Tex-Mex. Come celebrate 10 years. Yes, it took me 10 years of wonderful food and friendship at Cha-Cha's on Babcock between Wurzbach and Floyd Curl, across from the medical center. Open 7 days a week, lunch and dinner, and catering, you bet, no matter what the occasion. Cha-Cha's on Babcock. Call 615-7000, 615-7000.
Hi, Carl Wigglesworth, and I just found out about some myths regarding help in paying for nursing home care. I bet you believe in some of these myths, too. Things like, well, if you have any money, you really can't qualify for Medicaid assistance. Before you go any further in the myths, get the facts. Call the Medicaid case analyst at Chris Pettit & Associates Law Firm here in San Antonio. Here's their number, 824-6262. That's 824-6262. They'll be glad to send you a free brochure, no obligation at all. You do not need to spend all of your money on nursing home costs. And the law firm has worked with families who have assets or life savings as little as $40,000 up to hundreds of thousands of dollars, not including the value of your home. Again, give them a call. 824-6262. You don't have to give away all your money. You don't have to be without any money. Call the Medicaid case analyst at Chris Pettit & Associates, right here in town. 824-6262.
Welcome back. back to the Ron Thulin Show. Glad you're with us today. It is 47 past the hour of 12 o'clock. Coming up at the top of the hour, we'll be talking to Julia Gorin. She'll be giving us some political humor. And then at 2:30, by the way, we'll be talking with Sean Callahan, the Executive Vice President of Catholic Relief Services. We'll be talking about the Pakistan crisis, what you can still do to help them out. But in honor of Veterans Day, we are talking about a veteran from World War II, Conrad Nedding III, who passed away when his plane crashed. His son finally finding out about his dad. He was born a month after his father passed away. Has detailed it all in a book called Delayed Legacy. Conrad Nedding IV has been our guest. I want to talk to you about when you open that up. And the first time, when you first, you said everybody kind of stood there in awe. What did you feel when you saw the uniform, the names? That had to be just absolutely stunning for you.
It was. We were just without words, and I mean that literally. We made a video of it, and the video just goes silent for maybe a minute or something. My first thought was, my goodness, how am I so blessed as to have this? The second thought was, as we went through it, we found the flight log that was in there that had been put in by the Army when they sent his things home. Mm-hmm. And so over maybe a course of 5 or 6 minutes after we saw the uniform and I got all the kind of began to grasp what we had there, I said, well, let's look in the flight log. And we were reading these heroic episodes about a Messerschmitt comes at me at 400 miles an hour and I hit the plane and I claim it destroyed, and then Lieutenant so-and-so hit another one and I claim it as a partial destroy. All those technical kind of terms that come with pilot flight logs. And then out of the blue, I said, well, let's turn to June the 10th, the day he died, and just see what happens to be there. And on that page is where we read the epitaph from his best friend and roommate over there.
Was that Pat?
Pattyu is his last name. And he wrote this two-paragraph kind of eulogy and epitaph that was just, I couldn't read it. I tried three times to start it. I couldn't read it. And we finally read through it, and we were just in awe.
Because as a young boy, you're growing up without a father. At this moment, it seems like he became real.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't just a memory anymore.
Mm-hmm. He really did, and not only just from the evidence, the physical evidence, but the letters. Once we got into those letters, and remember now, this is maybe 2 years' worth of letters, two a day for 2 years, so one each way. You do the math. It's well over 1,000 letters, you really get to know people when they're writing every day. They get below the chit chat level. They get down into the depths of their heart and their feelings. They discussed in these letters what they wanted to do, how many boys they wanted to have. Four is the answer. I'm the first and last. They wanted to he wanted to fly. You know, typical 25-year-old. I'm going to fly the rest of my life. So there was all of that in there, but then there was this love, there was this devotion to country, this feeling of commitment, not of heroism ever or particularly of courage, but just, as you've heard so many times, we just had a job to do, we just went out and did it, and I say baloney. You know, you basically saved the world from tyranny, and thank you very much.
You didn't put all the letters in there for good reason.
No.
Obviously, some of them are very personal.
Yes.
But what insight did that give you into your father and mother's relationship and the love they had?
They were very deeply in love, and as to the extent you can understand that via the written word, and they were eloquent people. This would not be a book if they couldn't put a couple of words together.
Mm-hmm.
As I told you earlier, they wrote the book. I just assembled it. They could write very well. They were very careful in their words. They were very, in fact, my mother made a living writing ad copy almost the rest of her life. So she was no stranger to the written word. They did very good job of being able to convey in the written word what their feelings were for each other. I had no idea of that except from my mother's side, of course, from her conversations with me when she would say, oh, I love your father dearly, and we were just so in love. But then you read about it, and every day for 2 years, it just seeps into your soul about how devoted they were to each other.
And your mother kept a journal.
Yes.
And you finally got to see that.
That was part in the footlocker, yes. She, I call it a early form of therapy. I was looking in some publication the other day. I can't remember where this was. And there was it was a newspaper, I think, the Express. There was a list of support groups, and it filled the entire page of the Express. Mm-hmm. And it was every kind of topic you can imagine. Well, of course, those didn't exist back then. And as I said earlier, these ladies whose husbands were killed were not quite in the mainstream of society. Right. For those whose husbands came back, and as I said, all the joys and euphoria after the war. So they had to cope themselves and figure out their own way to support themselves. So my mother did that, in my view, by creating this journal, which mm-hmm. she wrote as if she was writing to my father, but it was, of course, letters that were never mailed.
Did it start right after he passed
yes.
away?
Yeah. Well, he was missing in action from the middle of June. She received a telegram in the middle of June that said he was missing in action. There's a very poignant phrase or excerpt in the book from that journal, too. And then he was declared killed in action in January of the following year, so almost 7 months that she kept this journal. Not really every day, but pretty close to it. And in that journal, you can just watch her go through this, what are now called the seven stages of grief or something, mm-hmm. Where she began, said, I know you'll come back. This is all a bad dream. You'll be fine. We'll get together. We'll have those four boys and buy the ranch that we always wanted. And then maybe a month or so later, it's, if you don't come back, but I'm sure you will, but if you don't, here's what I'll do. And then by December, she says, well, next year in 1945, one day in that year will either be the happiest of my life or the worst, and I'll find out exactly what's happened to you. And then she's getting herself closer to accepting the fact that he has died. And then, of course, by the end of January, she's fully understanding that.
Did you have to take days to read this journal because it was so emotional? You couldn't read it like, you know, five of her things she wrote in there at once.
No.
Did you have to take it and just kind of go?
Yes.
And tell your wife, Pauline, I got to step back.
Yes. We did that. We read it in sequence, and and within a few days, not many days, but a few days, it's very hard to read any of this as you would a novel. Just let's just read it until we fall asleep or something. But it was very, very hard to get through, very emotional. And some parts of the book, I've even written them, and I've reread them dozen or more times for the publisher, and I still have to stop and say, right. Okay, let me just get my thoughts together here and not just be a complete blithering idiot over this.
Unbelievable. Now that would be a fabulous story. This Foot Locker, you open it up, you find your mother's journal, you find everything about your father, but as Paul Harvey says, we've got to tell you the rest of the story.
That's exactly right.
You get this letter from France, correct?
Right. Correct.
You have no idea who these people are.
No clue.
Tell us about the letter and your reaction when you got this letter.
We received a letter in 2002 from a family in France that we had no previous contact with. They had found us, it turned out later, over the internet, and sent us a letter saying to the effect that your father was killed in our mm-hmm. village. Several of our villagers saw the plane crash. And we want to know more about him, his birthday, and so forth, because we are planning a memorial to him in our village. Knocked me over with a feather, had no indication that this was happening or this family even existed. The letter then continued, or another letter within the packet continued to say, not only did he die in our village, but this lady who was writing, my grandfather was the carpenter in the village, and he made the casket for your father's burial.
Oh.
Well, we couldn't get through that either. So within another page or so, it turns out that this gentleman, this carpenter, who must have been maybe 50 years old at the time, organized a secret burial for my father mm-hmm. in the village cemetery. The Germans still occupying Normandy, remember, four right. days after D-Day. They're still there, and in fact, they are until August. So they are having to bury my father under cover of night. They sneak around in the bushes, recover his body, bury him, and get it all done before daybreak. And when the Germans saw it, they were livid and did not want any more of that to happen. Mm-hmm. So they were doing this under severe pressure from the Germans.
So you get this letter, you look at it. Did you say immediately, we've got to go there?
Not quite immediately, but maybe within 24 hours. They said, we're having this memorial and we want to dedicate it. And so by now we're doing emails back and forth. And I said, well, gee, when are you going to have this? Maybe we could come over. Would you be willing to let us come over? And they said, oh, sure, we're having it on April 15th. And I said, well, let me tell you about April 15th and CPAs and the United States.
That's when you don't sleep.
I'm barely walking.
Guy in Atlanta's got guys like me calling him up April 14th saying, listen, you know that extension thing?
There you go.
Yeah.
So I said, well, don't think we can make it. Do you think it could be some other time? And they said, sure, why not? Well, as it turned out, we arrived there in Normandy on D-Day of 2002, on June 6th. Unbelievable coincidences, yeah. And so we did meet with them. We did dedicate the plaque. We took my family. I have three children, and we went to the cemetery. And that is, if you've not done that, you should go on a Veterans Day to any military cemetery and just try to get a sense of what's been sacrificed for us.
When you saw your father's grave,
mm-hmm.
I just saw Pauline just kind of duck her head, your wife.
Yes.
Probably not a whole lot was said.
No. We were overcome, as always, when you go to a military cemetery. If you can remember the very first scene in Saving Private Ryan, before the blood and guts, but right when the elder gentleman was shuffling into the cemetery, his family at a safe distance behind him, that's what you feel like. It's an outdoor cathedral. It is hallowed ground. In my father's cemetery, 4,400 plus markers, stars of David and crosses that are have these names on them, and all the dates of death are within a couple of weeks of each other. Now that's an arresting feeling right there, because you go to a normal cemetery, it can cover 100 years. Not here. They're all Patton's army was coming through, and they were. They were dying, I'm afraid, a lot were dying within a short time. But we got to my father's cross, and now my children at this time were probably 31 and 26 and 21 or so. Mm-hmm. So grown, but none of us could get to that site and not just have to just cry. I can't say we were emotional or all those catchphrases. We were just crying. And it was just a seeing him and a meeting him and a coming in spirit together with him all at once. And as one of my daughters said, we were the Conrads 3, 4, and 5 were all at the same place at the same time for the first time ever. So that was neat. My son is obviously the 5th.
This is an unbelievable story. On Veterans Day, and I made a point yesterday, and I got one email saying, you know, lighten up on it. I can't help it because I hear stories like this.
Right.
Were you ever bitter that your father was taken in a war at a young man? Because there are some families right now that are probably saying, I lost my dad in Iraq. Mm-hmm. This just isn't right in the bitterness. Mm-hmm. You have more of a sense of pride.
Mm.
In your father.
I have that, and I have a sense of distance. There's a 60-year gap here, and I see what that sacrifice has provided to us, which is nothing short of freedom. I mean, how could I go over to France in the first place if he hadn't died for our freedom? So I must say I am not bitter. I understand it. It is in God's own way that he has decided this shall happen. He does not make mistakes. So I am convinced that this is the way it was meant to be, for whatever reason, and I don't understand that reason, mm-hmm. and nor am I supposed to, but I am not bitter. I believe that my dad died protecting what he thought was worth protecting, which was nothing short of my life and my mother's life, not to mention the rest of this country, as did millions of others. Let's not forget, this story is universal. It resonates with all families, whether they're parents, fathers, mothers went to war or stayed behind is not the point. What's the point is that they sacrificed, and we're enjoying that today.
Before I let you go, the name of the book, by the way, is Delayed Legacy, and it is an emotional book. I'll be very honest with you that are listening out there, Delayed Legacy, but the cover of the book, when you saw this picture, it's got your father basically painted your name on his the nose of his aircraft.
Yes.
When you pulled out this particular picture, was that what really?
Well, I had seen the picture before. We did have a copy of that in my house when I was growing up, and at the time we opened it and saw it in the Foot Locker, it was just a revision of that history. It was like, oh, this is here as well. I was not just overcome by it at that point, but I'm telling you, when my dad named that plane for me 2 months before I was born, and never mind that he didn't know if I was a girl or a boy, it didn't matter to him, he was convinced. He put my name on it. And just 2 months ago, I was at a reunion of his group in Milwaukee, and the man who painted my name on that plane was there, so I got to meet him. And he didn't remember it from Adam, but I said, I don't care. You painted it. Thank you. It's nice to shake your hand.
This is Conrad. This is an incredible story.
Thank you.
Just unbelievable, touching story. It's a love story. Mm-hmm. It's a story of a boy loving his father, a mother loving the husband. It's an incredible story. Mm-hmm. The name of it's Delayed Legacy, and if you want to get a copy of it, here's what you need to do. Tonight between 7:30 and 9:30, Borders at the Quarry.
Right.
Everybody knows where the quarry is. Conrad's going to be there, and he'll be signing the book. And then tomorrow, if you can't make it tonight, you need to go to the Forum. That's at I-35 and 1604 at the Borders there from 2 to 4. Okay, so it's tonight, 7:30 to 9:30, Borders at the Quarry. And tomorrow from 2 to 4, Borders at the Forum. You can get copies of the book, and Conrad will be there to sign it.
That's right.
Spectacular.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely thank you. Incredible. I was been trying to get through the book, and I've got so many other books, but this thing, I just kept thinking, is this a war story? Is this a love story? Is this a, and but it's just a great story, is what it turned out to be.
I think that's the answer. It's just, it's universal. It appeals to everyone, and it's not just our story. It's for everyone.
And it also makes us think what this day is all about.
That's right.
Because this is real. Here is a son who lost his father, but is still very, very proud of him.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Once again, the name of the book is Delayed Legacy. We're going to take a break. 2 minutes past, about 3 minutes past the hour, 1 o'clock. ABC News is straight ahead. You're listening to The Ron Thulin Show on Call 1310.
The newest radio station on the dial. This is KAHL San Antonio. Call 1310.
Here's the latest from ABC News. I'm Pam Coulter. The Air Force Band with a musical tribute to the nation's vets at Arlington National Cemetery. Vice President Dick Cheney participated in the wreath laying while President Bush addressed soldiers and their families at the Tobiana Army Depot in Northeast Pennsylvania.
On this Veterans Day, we honor the courage of those who were lost in our current struggle. We think of the families who lost a loved one. We pray for their comfort.
In the face of growing anti-war sentiment, Mr. Bush struck back at war critics, accusing them of trying to rewrite history and saying they're undercutting American forces on the front lines. There was a Veterans Day skirmish at a military cemetery in Waterville, Maine. Protesters led by a veterans post tried to remove a peace display, 2,000 white flags meant to symbolize troops killed in Iraq. 5 protesters were arrested. Former New York Times reporter Judith Miller, who went to jail to protect source Scooter Libby in the CIA leak investigation, says there's not really a lot she'd do differently. But she declined to answer questions about the ongoing probe in an appearance at the National Press Club.
Well, you know what? I've been in jail for 85 days.